Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dory Smith.
The needs, aspirations, and rights of 1.4 million human beings have been reduced to an exercise in counting calories, megawatts, and other abstract one-dimensional units measuring distance from death.
Scholar and Yale Law School JD candidate Daryl Lee joins us to talk about his article in Middle East Report Online, Disengagement and the Frontiers of Zionism. This week's show is dedicated to the world's hungry, and we will be focusing on the people of Gaza as they're struggling to survive with limited food, water, electricity, and medical supplies due to an Israeli blockade. We also dedicate the show to my dad, David Truskoff, who has long been concerned about Palestinian rights. Season's greetings, Dad. Over more than five decades, my father struggled to communicate with his friends, and in particular his fellow Jewish friends, about the 60-year-long Israeli occupation of Palestinian land. Often his friends would agree with his anti-Vietnam War views, or much later his anti-Iraq War views, only to disagree bitterly when he complained about Israel's militancy toward Palestinians. During the 1980s, my dad survived a bout with Hodgkin's disease, a form of cancer usually treated with radiation and/or chemotherapy. Such care is not available in Gaza under conditions of the blockade. Here's a portion of an interview by Clancy Chassé of The Guardian. He interviews a Palestinian woman named Karima in Gaza, and she explains that she can't get her chemotherapy or her radiation and will die within 6 months.
This woman is dying. Her name is Karima. She is a 34-year-old mother of five, and she is in the advanced stages of cancer. Since Israel began punishing the Gazans for their support of Hamas, the entire territory has been under lockdown. For Karima, that means she has been unable to get out of Gaza to get the chemotherapy she needs. Her children are watching her die.
She says the people of Gaza don't deserve to suffer because of differences with Israel over Hamas.
Usually, with Karima's form of cancer, 9 out of 10 patients can survive. But without treatment, her doctors give her less than 6 months to live.
Karima spoke with Clancy Chassé of The Guardian 6 months ago. Her small children at her side, her mother looking on, explained that treatment could have cured her daughter already, but the checkpoint into Israel for such care had been closed. There is little media attention in the U.S. about what is happening to the people of Gaza. Granted, Americans are also suffering. In fact, Elizabeth Williamson writes in the Washington Post that the economic crisis in America has left many people out of work and struggling to make ends meet. This Thanksgiving holiday season finds 12% of Americans having trouble putting food on the table. But there is general agreement in the U.S. that something should be done to correct the problem of hunger in America. President-elect Obama has initiated a down payment plan, he says, to provide jobs and new infrastructure. However, Obama has not yet announced a plan to prevent further loss of life for Palestinians or Israelis and promote a lasting peace in the region. Here is UN spokesman Chris Guinness speaking to Robert Berger of VOA News, November 15th.
Of course, Israel has legitimate security concerns, and we respect that, and we respect the right, indeed the obligation of Israel to take action.
But Guinness said that is not a justification for cutting off food supplies, and he demanded that the borders reopen immediately.
Let's see this for what it is. 56% of the Gaza Strip are children. Let us not cause suffering of innocent children.
Daryl Lee is a doctoral candidate in anthropology and Middle Eastern studies at Harvard University and a JD candidate at Yale Law School. He has worked in Gaza for Human Rights Watch and B'Tselem, the Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories, as well as the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. Daryl Lee, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Talk about where things stand today with the blockade and how difficult it is to get food and medical supplies into Gaza.
Well, Dory, the blockade of the Gaza Strip has reached a sort of unprecedented level of wreaking humanitarian and economic destruction on the population of 1.4 million Palestinians, mostly civilians, who live in the territory. Now, it's almost impossible to bring basic foodstuffs, medical supplies, fuel, and essential parts and things for the functioning of infrastructure into the Gaza Strip. The indicators are always breaking new records every month, it seems, or every few months, in terms of the levels of unemployment, in terms of the percentage of the population beneath the poverty line, and now in terms of the dwindling food supplies in the Gaza Strip. So there's been this continuous trend that's gotten increasingly worse, especially in the past few weeks. But I think it's important for us to sort of step back and get some perspective on the situation as well. Essentially, what Israel has managed to do with the Gaza Strip since really from the mid-1990s to this day has been to gradually tighten the siege on the Strip and to essentially not only lower the amount of goods that are entering the Gaza Strip, but also to lower our expectations about what the situation there should be like. In the 90s, Israel was restricting ordinary trade and commerce into the Gaza Strip in a way that was crippling its economy, but not necessarily getting at the essential items that the population required for its survival. That was an unlawful act. It was extraordinarily destructive. It was very controversial at the time. But as the years went by, it basically became accepted that that was the normal situation. There was a new normal, if you will. And what's happened in the past couple of years, especially since the Hamas takeover in 2007, has been that Israel has essentially pushed the metric to a new lower normal, where we don't even talk about allowing Gaza to have a normal economy, but instead we debate what is the essential level of foodstuffs and medicines that is required for the population to biologically survive. So it's a completely different shift from, you know, when is it okay to restrict Gaza's economy, to a new situation in which we just assume that there is no economy or no right to an economy, and instead debate a much narrower question of basically what do Gazans need to keep living. And I think that is what we need to be paying attention to, because basically Israel has managed to lower the bar to the extent that it can keep Gaza and keep Gazans on an extremely short leash. It can close the borders knowing that there's only X number of days worth of food or X number of days worth of fuel or medicine in the Gaza Strip. And the international community will, you know, there might be an uproar, people will express concern, and then the Israelis will relax the siege just a little bit, and then it will seem like things are better. But actually, you know, we're still so far from what international law requires Israel as an occupying power to do in the Gaza Strip, and so far, you know, essentially from what basic justice and common sense would demand of the situation.
Well, your February 16th, 2008 report in Middle East Report Online certainly creates a dark picture, and I'm sure many people who are working with NGOs to try to solve the problem have been shaken by these new facts on what's going on there.
You know, we always get news that the situation in the Gaza Strip is getting worse, it's getting worse, it's getting worse, and there are new statistics about all of these different sort of socioeconomic indicators, but I think the way to contextualize that and the way to understand it is simply not just that it's getting worse, but that Israel is continuously revising downwards our expectations of what's acceptable. And that actually is what needs to be resisted, rather than fighting for an extra few trucks of food there or an extra few boxes of medical supplies there.
What about Israel's goals? I mean, it's clear they want to isolate Hamas, but have they realized any of their goals with this blockade tactic?
As I said before, I think we need to start with the macro level, which is that Israel has been gradually tightening its siege on the Gaza Strip since the mid-1990s. And I don't think this is attached to a very, very specific political goal of, you know, Hamas doing this or the Palestinians doing that, but it actually is much more about how they want to maintain control over the population of the Gaza Strip into the indefinite future. And that, I think that trend is really something that is much bigger than kind of the day-to-day political developments of who's up and who's down and who's agreed to what, you know, temporary ceasefire or whatever. In terms of the most recent manifestation of the siege and the phase that the siege has reached in the past couple of years, obviously, you know, the Hamas takeover of the Gaza Strip is the main thing that Israel is trying to reverse. So they've stated, you know, essentially that they want things to go back to the status quo, or they want Hamas to meet its essential preconditions for entering into a political process. So, you know, I think it's pretty clear to everyone that the Israeli position is that the people of the Gaza Strip voted for Hamas, and they should be made to suffer for their choice unless and until the Hamas government is either removed or agrees to Israel's preconditions. So those are the stated goals that I think, you know, it's conceivable that if that were to somehow happen tomorrow, that the siege might be loosened somewhat. But again, I want to emphasize that the underlying structural logic of the siege is something that has been going on for much longer and will probably outlast any kind of short-term political change. Because usually what will happen will be that, you know, there will be something like a ceasefire. For example, there's been a ceasefire between the Gaza Strip and Israel for the past few months. Things will get a little bit better in the short term, and then something will happen. There will be a provocation. For example, in this case, there was an Israeli incursion into the Gaza Strip on November 4th that resulted in some Hamas deaths. Then there were rockets fired from the Gaza Strip into Israel, and then, of course, the siege was tightened. So you get into this very, very narrow question of who started what and when. And, of course, the Israelis will say, well, you know, we had to do this because there was an intelligence warning and so on. And then these very small debates about who started what and the tit-for-tat, I think, are actually, you know, a distraction from the much, much broader kind of structures at work. You know, even if there's a small bit of progress or concession from one side or another on a very narrow thing that leads to a temporary relaxation of the siege in the short term, a relaxation of someone's grip on your arm doesn't change the fact that they have a grip on your arm and that they can easily tighten that grip again in the future should they so desire.
Which has been the more clear Israeli agenda, pushing Hamas out politically or keeping Hamas from growing as a force that could take care of the humanitarian needs of Palestinians in Gaza?
Well, I don't think those are mutually exclusive outcomes. I think the Israeli perspective is something like, if we get Hamas pushed out, that's great, that's a victory for us. If we embitter the population and make it very difficult for Hamas to take care of their needs, we still perpetuate divisions in Palestinian society between Hamas and Fatah that keep the Palestinians preoccupied with their own internal issues. So that's a win for them too. So, you know, I think there's lots of different strategic outcomes that could be supported by inflicting collective punishment on the civilian population, unfortunately.
You write about what this humanitarian crisis is like in terms of how the people of Gaza are being treated. And you compare this to the treatment of animals in a pen. Would you just read that paragraph for us?
Sure. I think all of this talk about a humanitarian crisis in the Gaza Strip shouldn't distract us from Israel's policy of treating the territory like an animal pen, like a space of near-total confinement whose wardens are concerned primarily with keeping those inside alive and tame, perhaps with some degree of mild concern as to the opinions of neighbors and other outsiders. The needs, aspirations, and rights of 1.4 million human beings have been reduced to an exercise in counting calories, megawatts, and other abstract one-dimensional units measuring distance from death. My contention is that Israel has moved from treating the Gaza Strip like a Bantustan labor reserve of the kind we saw in South Africa in the 1970s, that it went from that model of control, which it used from the 1970s through the 1980s, to a model of control of treating the Gaza Strip like an internment camp, which is what it did in the 90s, and now it treats the Gaza Strip more like an animal pen, essentially. The difference being that in Bantustan, the people who live there are allowed to migrate and do work for you, but they have to go back and live on the reserve at the end of the day, so there's some form of residential segregation, but economic exploitation. In the 90s, during Oslo, it was a prison camp. They kept everyone there, but they tried to control them and allow them to manage themselves internally, you know, to organize their own leaders, right, the so-called Palestinian Authority. The phase that we're in now, I think, is more like an animal pen. The big question on everyone's minds is the survival of the people who live inside. So we're not concerned about whether or not the people inside have freedom. We're not concerned about whether or not they live under a political regime that allows them to, you know, enjoy the principles of freedom and equality. But instead, we're basically just asking, are these people about to die or not? Are they being fed enough? Do they have enough medicine? And I think that's a much, much narrower question and a much, much further distraction from the fundamental issues that are at stake in the conflict. So essentially, you know, the article is arguing that there's this new form of control, which I call disengagement, which basically is about making every debate about the essential humanitarian needs of the population and not debating what are the basic political issues at stake, what is the possibility for creating a political regime based on equality and freedom and justice in the region. That's what things are about at the end of the day, but that's just something that we never talk about. Instead, we talk about how many trucks of food are getting in, we talk about who fired the first shot in the latest tit-for-tat, we talk about, you know, which diplomatic plan of the moment is being talked about. I mean, the, you know, I think what we really need to talk about is what are the political outcomes that we think make sense for everyone involved, and how do we get there in terms of organizing and mobilizing the different constituencies who are involved, Jews, Arabs, Palestinians, Israelis, and so on. For me, those are the important questions.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice used a racing analogy to describe where things stand with the peace plan outlined at Annapolis in 2007, saying if Palestinians and Israelis stay on the Annapolis course, they're going to cross the finish line and can do so relatively soon. Daryl Lee, what about the fact that so many Palestinians are right now starving, dying from treatable diseases like diabetes? Many won't make it across that finish line.
With all due respect to the Secretary, her grasp on reality is about as strong as her political relevance at this moment. The idea that there will be a peace agreement before the next administration comes in, or indeed any time in the near future, is something that I don't think anyone expects will happen. There's a very basic problem right now, which is that the Palestinian side, if you will, is very, very deeply divided. And the United States and Israel have imposed a number of conditions, both diplomatically and in terms of how they're affecting the situation on the ground, that are making Palestinian reconciliation and Palestinian unity almost impossible. I think it's fair to say that Palestinian national unity, i.e. reconciliation between Hamas and Fatah, is something that Israel and the United States have unfortunately sought to frustrate over the past few years. Now, I think it's fair to say that anyone who's interested in a peace agreement and in having just a stable treaty that can be enforced has to recognize that you need to have one address to talk to, one group of people to negotiate with. So, you know, obviously, there in the internal Hamas-Fatah dispute, there's all sorts of different things that one could say. One doesn't have to take sides necessarily, but I think there is a basic point that unless and until there is some degree of Palestinian unity and cohesion, there just can't be a stable peace agreement. And I think that's basically why it makes sense for Israel, at least, to make sure that there is no stable partner, because as long as there's no stable partner, there's no viable political process. And as long as there's no viable political process, they have the time and the space they need to continue their settlements and their demographic transformation of the West Bank, which I think basically is really what's going on here, essentially to just keep expanding the settlements and to shift the game in the West Bank in their favor, demographically speaking, such that if and when there has to be a peace agreement in the future, they'll be in a much stronger position. And of course, it will seem completely unrealistic to remove the settlers. So I think the state of Israel is playing for time. And I think the strategy, at least for the time being, seems to be working. So one thing that I think the incoming Obama administration should take heed of is to recognize that this problem is only going to fester in the region and only going to create massive human suffering and jeopardize strategic interest on all sides, including the strategic interest of the United States, and that a real, viable, and just agreement has to happen sooner rather than later. And that this idea of just letting things go on in the way that they are and allowing the Israelis to play for time is not going to help that for anyone, and including for Israel in the long term.
Daryl Lee, just give us a little overview of the history of Hamas, the roots of Hamas.
You know, I'm not an expert on Hamas, but I think the basic narrative that most people agree on is that they are an outgrowth of the Muslim Brotherhood, al-Ikhwan al-Muslimun, in the region. The Gazan branch of Hamas primarily grew out of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood. The West Bank branch grew out of the Jordanian Brotherhood. Those are quite different traditions. And for a long time, Muslim Brotherhood was actually considered one of the more quietest strands of Palestinian politics. So there was a long time when the approach of the Muslim Brotherhood was to refrain from confrontation with Israel, because what was needed was focusing on spiritual matters and uplifting the population so that they could be ready for a confrontation much later. So I think, you know, in the 70s, even to a certain extent in the 80s, it was often the secular Palestinian factions who accused so-called Islamist factions of essentially not doing enough to confront Israel. And it's only really in the late 80s onwards that we get this idea of Islamist groups being more violent, more radical, and more hardcore, if you will, than the secular Palestinian groups.
Just clarify, though, Hamas, these are not outside groups. These are Palestinians.
Of course, it is a Palestinian organization. I don't think there's any serious dispute of that. People will say or insinuate that Hamas are just, puppets or cat's paws of Iran or whoever. I don't think there's any serious dispute that Hamas's leadership and its rank and file are based in the occupied territories. And actually, one of the differences in the 1980s, during the first Intifada, between Hamas and the PLO factions was that the PLO factions were ultimately answerable to a leadership in exile, whereas Hamas had its primary political leadership inside the occupied territories. Now, today, of course, there's, some major Hamas political leaders do live in exile, people like Khaled Mashaal, but I think it's fair to say that the center of gravity in the movement is definitely inside the occupied territories. I think the main outcome of the First Intifada was that Israel decided it could no longer exploit Palestinian labor for cheap in large quantities. Because anytime you have people working for you, you depend on them. And if they go on strike, it raises your cost. So I think they made a strategic decision to end or to reduce their dependence on Palestinian labor. And that's why Gaza moved from being a labor reserve to essentially an internment camp. And the people inside were rendered superfluous from the point of view of the Israeli economy. And that is when you have the kinds of isolation and desperation that give rise to things like suicide bombing. So Hamas decided, in this context, to oppose the Oslo agreements and to stay outside the Oslo agreements, pointing out all the flaws of the Oslo framework that people are aware of today. And that, of course, set them on a course of confrontation with the Palestinian Authority. And I guess the rest is history.
We're speaking with Daryl Lee. He has worked in Gaza for Human Rights Watch and other non-governmental organizations seeking to ensure the legal rights and human rights of Palestinians. As the leadership changes in Washington, Israelis are also preparing for an election in February. Tzvi Lipsy, a former Mossad agent, took over as head of the Kadima Party after winning an election in September. Right-wing Likud Party candidate Benjamin Netanyahu is considered the leader, according to some polls. Netanyahu has already served as prime minister once and has come under scrutiny after issuing calls for attacks on Iran. The current prime minister, Ehud Olmert, is stepping down over corruption charges. He has surprised many people by calling for a withdrawal from the occupied territories so Israelis might establish a lasting peace. I asked Daryl Lee what changes in leadership might mean in terms of any policies affecting Palestinians and how the softening of rhetoric toward Iran might have an effect.
I don't think there's that much that rides on these elections because at the end of the day, the state of Israel is so fundamentally and infrastructurally invested in building and expanding settlements in the West Bank that unless there's some real counter pressure, either from the United States or from the Palestinians, if they ever manage to get organized, that it would be very, very difficult, even for a relatively left-wing administration in Israel, to, for example, unilaterally remove large numbers of settlements. I think that's a very, very difficult thing. Sharon was able to remove 6,000 settlers, slightly more than 1% of the number of settlers in the West Bank, and that was not a very politically easy thing to do, but he got enormous concessions from the United States in return, diplomatic concessions in terms of recognizing or quasi-recognizing annexations and settlements in the West Bank. I don't think there's any reason to expect why any Israeli administration would bear the enormous domestic political cost of giving up settlements, evacuating settlements, of decolonizing the West Bank, unless they were forced to do so by counter-pressures from outside. And I don't see those counter-pressures emerging from the Palestinian side in the near future because of their own divisions. And I don't really see those pressures coming from the U.S. administration because of how our foreign policy towards the region is distorted. So in terms of the big picture outlook on settlements in the West Bank, I just don't expect a lot to change. The only change I expect in the near future is continuous expansion of settlements.
Barack Obama was successful at softening America's rhetoric about Iran, the Bush administration, and eventually John McCain, too, pulling back from these arguments about a U.S. and or Israeli attack on Iran. Do you think that softer rhetoric will make a difference in U.S. and Israeli policy?
You know, to be honest, I don't know what to expect from the Obama administration. There were a lot of things said during the campaign, both by the campaign and against the campaign, about its positions in the Middle East. And, you know, campaign promises are exactly that. They're promises made in the context of the campaign. They're not policy. I don't know if the Obama administration will actually take a more open stance towards Iran or not. The appointment of Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State doesn't seem very promising. You know, it's fair to say that she's one of the most hawkish members of the Democratic Party and possibly of the Senate when it comes to Middle East issues. It's quite unfortunate. So it could very well be the case that this is an area of U.S. foreign policy that maintains consistency and bipartisanship across the administrations. I hope that's not the case. I don't put that much stock in sort of the idea that change is coming to Washington in a significant way. I hope to be proven wrong, but if we look at the kinds of appointments that Obama has made, both in terms of foreign and domestic policy, we see a lot more continuity than reform.
Daryl Lee, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You can find articles by Daryl Lee online at merip.org. That's M-E-R-I-P. That's Middle East Report. Daryl Lee has worked in Gaza for Human Rights Watch and other non-governmental organizations. His name is spelled Daryl, D-A-R-R-Y-L, Lee, L-I. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program produced at the studios of WHUS at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live, Wednesdays at 5 p.m. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions.